Accession number 28750, Reel 3.
Laurie Manton, Reel 3.
The other interesting thing on this pre-battle preparation, which was again something that members of the public wouldn't think about at all, and I've always remembered, and it sounds a little crude, but it's not. But we were all advised to go into action wearing clean desert uniform that had been laundered, clean underpants, and to wash before we went into battle. And it is evidently a commonly known thing in the military, although again, when I was in the military, I never faced action, so I'd never come across it. But the reason for this is that when you move around in your day, and if you go to the toilet and things like this, little bits of excrement might remain in your underwear, and then the smallest fragments, which seems unbelievable, of germs and skin, you know, the skin that flakes off and then fills your trousers and such like. If you're shot, you've got contamination round the wounds. And so that was the aim of having to wear a clean uniform, clean underpants, and to have washed before you initially went into battle, to save any extra contamination of any gunshot or shrapnel wounds you might get. So you can imagine the, you know, everyone washing before they went to war.
Yes, it's sort of sinister in a way, isn't it?
It's definitely not an apocryphal story, because we were briefed that and everyone did it.
Yeah. Was all this unusual in your experience? The, you know, particularly that briefing to give the, really, the worst case, wasn't it, scenario? Was that, it seems to me it would have been very bad for morale for men going into battle, to know that even if they were wounded, they were liable to be run over. You know, that one of the...
I'm still astonished by it now, 14 years afterwards. But I think it was best to be realistic. And, you know, if you saw someone whose inside of their respirator was bubbling up with vomit, and they were making this horrible gurgling and screaming noises, you would naturally go to assist them. And you would naturally go to assist them before you'd actually got your gas mask on properly and sealed up your NBC suit and put your gloves on and such like. So, you know, if you haven't sorted out yourself first, then you become a casualty as well and would probably die.
It's a bit like on a plane, isn't it, where they tell you to put on your, before you see to a child. But how worrying was it for you, this fear of biological and chemical weapons? And did you have to wear one of these suits?
Yeah, well, frequent alerts. I have to say, having spent the late 60s and early 70s in Germany, and where we forever exercised, retreating before the Russian hordes when they invaded, using their chemical and biological and nuclear weapons, then it was second nature to put the suits on, which NBC suits are, you know, dubbed noddy suits because you look so silly in them. So I was quite used to that. And I was retrained at Aldershot in the use of it.
That must have been a great advantage, wasn't it, from what I've heard from other people who hadn't.
There's an art to getting it all on. But there was an occasion, the first time, and we were out in the desert travelling around, and we're out on some of the desert roads, which are actually made up roads. And we were just leaving a unit, going on the main road, and someone had come in and said, Cor, this is it now. Way before the war started proper, Saddam Hussein's forces have fired Scud missiles at Israel. And someone said, they'll just send their nuclear weapons straight over onto Baghdad. Well, we drive off across the desert to find some military policeman in the middle of nowhere. And before you got into full NBC, there was a face mask. Funny, sinister little, you look like a bit of an alien. It just went over your mouth and nose. And this guy waved us down and said, put this on, put your face mask on. Why? Because the Israelis have fired missiles and we don't know what they are yet. And we then saw a big unit where we wanted to report further on, and we arrived and we just got in the tent and all the chemical warfare detectors sounded. So we put all our gear on and thought, well, there was no point in sitting here. So we wandered out in the open and we went out and started interviewing and photographing the people in their gear. But, you know, if we're going to die, then we might as well, you know, we were there to record history, if you like. So we did all this, and we went out. Then there was a thought that perhaps something had not happened. But one person always has to do the sniff test. They go out in the middle of wherever they are, and they take off their respirator, and they go... And if they go, ugh, and die... You'll know that there's still stuff around, a bit self-sacrificing for an individual that has to do it. So we went and documented this, and the guy was all right. So it was fine. But you get, it was the first time, we'd done loads of alerts, but it was the first time either of us had felt really iffy because of this connection with him scudding the Israelis.
Is that poor chap who does the sniff test, does he volunteer for this, or is it...
I think he's part of those that's involved in the sort of detection. So, you know, it's his job, so he has to do with it. But I hadn't been to church for years. I was a Catholic. And I just happened to be sheltering in the tent afterwards when the Roman Catholic padre came in. Does anyone here want communion? I said, yes, please. So I went up the steps into the back of his little truck, and he got out his field communion kit that they carry around in war, and he set it up. So he's giving me communion, and I'm looking at this brass crucifix, and as my eyes go down past the body of Christ, there's a skull and crossbones on it. And I thought, I can't believe this, and I've tried to track this chap down ever since. Because Catholics don't have skull and crossbones on their crucifixes. Now, whether it had been specially made for him by his regiment or what have you, but that's remained with me. My urgent need to receive communion after a couple of decades of not going to church. So, you know, obviously did have an impact.
Yeah, you were really... thought this might be it, might have been it.
Well, I think what worried me was that in the run-up to the war, when we were still in Saudi Arabia and in the different sort of military barracks that were set up, which are quite comfortable, but they decided to have a lot of exercises because no one had been in respirators long-term in living memory. And people's physical fitness declines rapidly if you're wearing these things. So they started making us sleep in them. And I couldn't sleep in a respirator. And I lay there for about 6 hours going, this freaking cold, clammy plastic, you know, sort of against my cheek. And after 6 hours, I just took it off. Because I couldn't cope with the claustrophobia of having this on my face, which would have meant if there had been a thing after 6 hours, I would have given up and effectively killed myself. But, you know, wearing the respirator was worse than the prospect of being killed by Iraqis.
Yeah. And there was a real fear then, was there, that, that, you know, chemical, nuclear, biological weapons might be used in that war?
Oh, very much so. I think most people were surprised that they weren't. You know, we had all the jabs against much of the stuff. We'd been taking the NAPS tablets, the nerve agent pre-treatment tablets, daily. Well, and that worried people after the war because it turned out to be come from the Americans and wasn't licensed over there because it contained things like weed killer, an equivalent. And like the servicemen, I had vaccinations against anthrax, the plague, and many other things as well. So well done. We had good equipment, protective equipment, the noddy suits and the respirators.
Were you worried at all about all these jabs and tablets?
Not at the time. Although I think most people were fed up, and one of the tablets, and I think it may well have been the anthrax tablet, or the plague. And at the same time, it was given with a whooping cough jab, which meant it kicked in faster. But it gave everyone that had it flu. So, so they, you know, they inoculated the whole of the army, and for 48 hours, everyone's dying from a flu. So they were all under the weather. It could have been worse. You could have this flu and then go to the dentist, because the dentist, they had foot pedal powered drills to drill holes in your teeth, and you know how high speed the dentist drills are. Well, these things revolve very slowly with this foot pedal, a bit like a potter's wheel. It went round and ground very slowly. So better the flu than a visit to the dentist.
So you would have been there through the air war and the ground war as well, would you?
Well, I first went out in November 1990 and spent 3 weeks or so going around the British troops, reporting on their training activities, interviewing various senior figures and such like, spending a little time with the Americans. And then we'd be rotated, and another team would come out, and you'd go home and just do your ordinary work. There was a team out there when the ground war started. The air war started. And I arrived. I stayed there over Christmas to ensure, by myself as well, I was really annoyed about that, to ensure that we didn't lose our vehicle. And then I was joined by the photographer to prepare for the ground war proper. And it was a hired Mitsubishi four-wheel drive vehicle, which we then, bearing in mind it was hired from a hire company, we then put this most grotesque, thick, sand-coloured paint all over it. We then found that we had to put an orange recognition panel on the top to stop us being shot by the Americans. All the military vehicles had convoy lights where they could click a switch, so the only light was a very small white light at the back of the vehicle that the one behind would follow. And we had ordinary electrics on this, so we had to tear the electrics out, which was a bit disconcerting. And we did various exercises. There was a big drive across the desert for 36 hours, which is quite tiring. We got lumped in with an ITN reporter, who's ITN's US correspondent at the moment, Robert Moore. And a more miserable bloke I've never come across, who would hardly converse with us at all. you know, got to the point where he said he can walk, just so so miserable. And whereas, you know, me having been an ex-squadian, my photographer Mike was ever resourceful, I thought, right, we'll go to one of the shops in Saudi before we set off on this, and we bought, you know, crates of these little Kiora orange drinks and a little Chinese water heater and a kettle and things like this, so we could at least make booze. And this guy was completely unprepared, so he was eating our biscuits and drinking our drinks, and, you know, didn't even say thank you at the end. He just stepped out of the vehicle and was gone. But, you know, it went on and on, and then it just came to the time of the briefing. At the briefing, we were suddenly... Everyone was drinking bottled water just before the war started. And they were dumping all the bottled water. And I knew where there was a load of it, so I drove a mile down the road and filled the back of my vehicle with it. Water that would be thrown up. And I can remember Kate Ady coming in and saying, I want to rinse my knickers. Have you got any water? And I gave her a bottle, and she was caught with it. And this very regimental major wanted to have me court-martialed for misuse of water, and he wouldn't have it. And I said that, you know, hey, I'm a civilian, it's being thrown away, you'll see you're being unreasonable and all the rest of it. So he decided not to. And within an hour of getting ready to start, they said, oh, and by the way, you're taking a reporter from the Scottish Daily Record through with you on the ground war. Well, why don't you tell us? You know, so I threw a big wobbly, but we had to throw out gear to get rid of, to make space for this guy. And then we set off, and there was huge traffic jams. And they'd had like a big sandbank on the Iraqi border, and the engineers had bulldozed the way through, and then someone had put a sign up. It was some US engineers that had done it, and said, you know, breach in berm by courtesy of the US, whatever. And the traffic jam was the fact that every time one of our vehicles in the convoy, and there were hundreds, got there, it would stop. They'd all rush out and get their photo taken next to the sign of the hole in the berm, and jump back in their vehicle and drive on again because they would do the souvenir shots. Now, we've been given the chance of going through with one of the tank regiments, and ummed and ahed about it, and we were assured that we would see more where we were because we'd be flown to a hospital to see the wounded or flown to see the action and such like. So we stayed where we were. And we spent our time flying across the desert trying to catch up with people. And eventually we parked up in lines of vehicles about 100 yards apart. There were water tankers on wheels, which was almost like chlorinated water. Wasn't really chlorinated, it had something in it, and it was disgusting. And they had this wonderful tinned bacon grill that they used to fry. It's in part of the compo rations that the military have. But they'd thrown all this stuff in boiling water, and if you boil spam effectively, it tastes disgusting, and that's all there was to eat. And one of the things that still affects me this day was the fact that if you needed to go for a poo, for example, you'd walk out 30 feet, dig a hole and do it there, and there'd be several hundred people all around you. And I found that terrible. The squaddies were used to it. I became used to it eventually, but when I came back from the Gulf War, I always liked my privacy now. But it's a fact of life. Now, I'd done it when I was a soldier, all those years in Germany on exercise, but you went off into the forest and you found somewhere secluded, you dug your hole, you did your business, filled it up, filled up the hole and came back again. But because you were in cleared lanes and areas where there were no mines, you were fairly well stuck. And every time we stopped, we had to dig shell scrapes that we could just roll into should there be explosions or anything like that, and the shrapnel should go over your head. But we dug some pretty spectacular ones. And as we were moving off at darkness, it was just the first sort of dusk was coming. So everyone thought, well, we'll use these holes for privacy. So we'll all go to the toilet in these shell holes. Blow me down, K80 has got hold of some American rations, of which they have nice tinfoil wrapped cherry cake slices, and wandered down the line of trenches asking people whether they wanted a slice of cake. And we always joked about it that every single man in those trench who was caught in the act suffered with constipation for the next week. And Kate was completely oblivious to the chaos she was she was causing.
I think she had a few problems with regarding this. It must have been difficult for women reporters.
That
situation, you know, but not to talk so. About with cherry cake.
Absolutely, but then it was then we became aware that they were building a prisoner of war camp just up on the hillside, and they were filling RAF Chinook helicopters, which take ever such a lot of people, full of Iraqi prisoners, landing, chucking them out and going off to get more. And I got permission to go up there with my vehicle with the guy from the Daily Record and Ken Lennox, who was then the Sun photographer. And of course, there wasn't the fuss about the Geneva Convention and you can't photograph the prisoners' faces like there was in the second Gulf War. So we had carte blanche. So it's quite interesting. And one of the interesting cases there was a guy that ran up to one of the photographers and said, "Oh, this is terrible." He said, "I'm only on holiday from London." You know, he's an Iraqi. He says, "Look." And he had his front door key in his hand. He says, "I just come to my parents' house." He says, I'm just sticking my key in the front door and they picked me up and put me on a truck and sent me to Kuwait. So there are all these poor people. They're all suffering from trench foot and things like that. They were being shot by the Republican Guard if they thought about leaving. And they're the ones that were being, you know, massacred by the Americans when they were doing the big bombardment. I'll never forget this guy with the key. You know, just an ordinary person. So then there was, unfortunately, another fairly pompous young officer who came up to me and said, "How dare you let the photographers photograph the prisoners?" I said, "Well, the colonel said I should escort these people up. You have to remember that I am a journalist. I'm an MOD press officer as well." "No," he said, and he jumped on the bonnet of my vehicle. He said, "Take me to the colonel." I thought, right. So I drove off with him clinging to the bonnet of my vehicle across country and got to the colonel's caravan, which is a bit like Monty's caravan in the war, and he was sitting on the steps, and I jammed the brakes on, and this officer flew off the bonnet, rolled over and over, and at the colonel's feet, Colonel, Manson took the journalists up to see the prisoners. He said, "Yes, I asked him to." Yeah. So there was a bit of that to fight against. But that was interesting because they were busing in the prisoners as well, in the equivalent of the American school buses. So they fill them up with, you know, Iraqi soldiers and drive them in. But, you know, virtually every one of them was so pleased to be a prisoner, which is incredible when you think about it. And from there, because it was such a short war, a 100-hour war, they called it, they decided that we would then travel across country. And we were in an area with loads of burning tanks around, I think.
I was going to ask you, was there much sign of fighting and battle?
Well, yeah, it's very interesting because when these armoured vehicles, which seem to have a high aluminium content, burn, it's the most intensive iridescent blue jet of flame coming from it. It's absolutely astonishing. Beautiful, if you can call something like that. Beautiful. And they said to people, right, there's a ceasefire. We're going to go into Kuwait near the Mutla Ridge, where the those Iraqi convoys are shot up, which I think caused George Bush to think it was a Turkish shoot, and public opinion felt he should stop the war and not go any further. But everyone is to unload their weapons because the war has ended. And one of the sergeants, I remember, said, supposing some Iraqi maniac hasn't heard that and starts firing, well, you have to, you know, put your bullets back in your magazine. And he said, they're not doing that. You know, and he was told off in no uncertain terms that, you know, he had to unload his rifle and all the rest of it. So we then drove for miles across the desert, and it was absolutely astonishing time. As far as you could see was red tail lights going up and down over the sand dunes. And eventually we arrived, and we were told we were in Kuwait, and a dreadful sandstorm blew up. It's the first one I'd experienced, and it's very difficult to cope with, which is why everyone also had their own goggles to wear. So we arrived there. I burst open a compo ration pack and filled a big drum full of, you know, stew and everything else going, cooked it and filled my face with this. And the next day we're invited to go off to see the carnage at the Mutla Ridge, and I went off with Kate Ady and a few other people, and we drove for miles along this main road, no traffic, and suddenly we'd see feel the Land Rover swerve, and looking out the back, you know, there's a dead body on the tarmac, and then another one. And then we arrived up, and there was a couple of Royal Engineer vehicles there, armoured vehicles with bulldozers on the front. And they said, you know, just hang on a bit, we're just about to explode a booby trap, and they blew that up. And they said the only way to get through to the other side is to go down the side, and we've cleared a path with our tracks through the minefield, and then you can get back on the main road where all the Iraqi shot up vehicles are. Well, we set off, and then we suddenly realised that there was four of us in four-wheel drive vehicles. So large were these combat tractors that their tracks, where the clear path was outside where our tyres were. So a bit nervy over that. And then we arrived, and it was a six-lane highway, and I did drive the length. It was 3.8 kilometres of highway, nose to tail, burnt out and wrecked Iraqi vehicles. And what they'd done, the Americans had sealed off on the Baghdad side of the Mutla Ridge, stopped the convoy, and then all the American helicopter gunships came in and started machine gunning the convoy.
End of Veal 3, Lorry Mountain.